And a very good evening to you. 6 o'clock in the nation. I'm Greg Stinsealy. Welcome to another edition on this Sunday evening of the Better Health Radio Show. And we want to welcome Dr. Renee Boyce as she gets ready to present to you another riveting show. Good evening, Dr. Boyce.
Hi, good evening, Redston. How are you?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. And what about yourself? Smiling lovely as usual?
It is so good to see you again.
Yeah, it seems like eternity. Yeah, long time since.
It has been a while.
Yes, indeed.
So good evening to everybody and welcome to the Better Health Radio Show, where we help you to live your best life. We had a little hiatus over the past 4 weeks. I think that has been the longest that we have gone over the past 5 years without having a show. So there were many persons who were checking to see whether we were okay or not, Gryson. And I want to say a very big shout out and thank you to those persons who were looking after our well-being, who wanted to make sure that we were not on death's door and that there wasn't any other serious life event that had caused us to be away from the show. But life happens. Certainly there are things over which we have no control, but it is good for us to be back here. And I, you know, speaking on Grayson's behalf, I think that on this show, I do have liberty to do that.
I guess you do.
To speak on his behalf. So to Ian and to Nancy and to Frederick and to all those persons who would have seen me on the road as well and asked if everything was okay, and those persons who were sending in greetings to Gryson as well, we really do want to say thank you. We thank you for the outpouring of love and appreciation. And it really does go to show that you value what we bring here to you every Sunday, except for the past 4 Sundays. And this evening, if you want to give Gryson a call in the studio, the number is 434-1790.
Yep, correct.
And to do the WhatsApp, 266-4862. So those digits again, 434-1790. And for the WhatsApp, it's 266-4862. Now, if we've been listening to the news, we have been hearing all about childhood obesity. That has been a topic that has been in the headlines for quite a period of time. And it needs to be in the headlines because it really is important. One of the things is that obese children go on to be, in most cases, obese adults. And we know here in Barbados all about the high rates and the high incidence of diabetes and hypertension and the consequent loss of limb and dialysis and so on. This evening, as our guest, I have someone who I can call a friend of mine. He's been on the show before, and we are going to discuss, yes, I qualify friend. We are going to discuss all about nutrition. And so welcome to you, Mr. Brian Payne. Thank you so much again for appearing as one of our guests.
Hi, good evening, good evening. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to come and have a nice candid discussion.
All right, so let us hit the ground running. We are going to talk about all about nutrition as much as we can get in. And this, as usual for the show, those questions that you have about nutrition, you're wondering about diets and so on and so forth. Brian is a wealth of information, a repository of information, and therefore now would be a good time to get those questions in and get those questions answered with somebody here who is available to you free of cost. Right, so Brian, when we talk about diet, automatically in the minds of the vast majority of persons, they go to some sort of restrictive process and aim to lose weight. But as a nutritionist, what does diet mean to you?
I mean, I think you're spot on in saying that when people hear the term diet, automatically they assume we're talking about some kind of calorie restriction to lose weight. We know that we're having Karpova again this year. So, you know, so the buzzword is diet to get in shape. But the term diet from a nutrition standpoint, it basically means your typical daily consumption, simply put.
So for those persons who are in shock at hearing that that is what diet is what you eat. Full stop, the end. And we can extrapolate from that, we can go from there and say the quality of life you lead is dependent upon, among other factors, but dependent upon the food that you put in your mouth. One of the things that I have realized as a physician, and it never ceases to amaze me, we have to do calculations, or, well, we should do calculations of body mass index. And with body mass index, it divides persons into various categories of underweight, normal weight, overweight, and obesity. And I found over the years that when I tell persons that they fall into the obese category, there's a long period of silence as persons are trying to grapple with the fact that they are obese by medical standards. Have you found this same thing occurring when you are dealing with your patients?
Yeah, I mean, when I used to work more in the clinics, I mean, to tell someone they're obese, I mean, they often are very shocked. I think the issue here, or the disconnect here really, is that people generally underestimate their weight. You know, so when they're told based on the body mass index, you know, you're falling the obese or extremely obese range, or the morbid obese range, I think even the overweight range, I think people are surprised. And I think people are very keen to push back. They say, oh, the body mass index is a European tool or North American tool, and it doesn't represent the typical Black person. Again, and that in itself is not accurate either. I think the body mass index was a tool that was developed from a wide cross-section of persons from different ethnicities, different races, and across several populations across the world. But again, the body mass index is not a perfect tool. So let's say for persons who may be athletic or muscular or fit, it may not represent their weight status or their nutrition status accurately. Again, because these persons generally have more muscle mass to fat ratio. So within that regard, using something like percentage muscle mass to percentage body fat would be a better tool. But in a clinical setting for the general population, the body mass index gives us a very, very clear picture of a person's weight status.
Yes, and sometimes as patients and as individuals, you know, we low-key know that our weight is not what it should be. We know that we don't exercise, we know that we don't eat what we should, and therefore the consequence is being either overweight or obese, and subsequently the development of the chronic non-communicable diseases. I am sure that every Barbadian is officially tired of hearing NCDs, NCDs, NCDs. And whilst that's the case, it's in our ears all the time, there has not been that necessary change, or the significant necessary change to change the direction of where this country is going with respect to managing those non-communicable diseases. And when we say non-communicable, we simply mean that they're not transferred from one person to another by being in close proximity. It would be wonderful if obesity was a communicable disease, because, you know, you could find a person who was slim and needed to have a little extra patty, stand next to them and give them some of your extra fat. But it really does not work that way. In our society, persons have become very educated, and we are able to justify the reasons for not living the way that we should. In your clinical experience, and we're going to talk about what you do for a living just in just a few seconds, but in your clinical experience, what are some of the reasons that persons give for not eating properly?
I think the primary reason would be, well, two of the primary reasons are they say they don't have the time to eat properly, and they also speak about the cost factor of eating quote-unquote healthy versus unhealthy eating. And cooking skills is another big one as well.
Okay, so let's say those again. So you said, remind me, sorry.
So the first one would be persons say they don't have enough time to prepare healthy meals. The second thing that people tend to associate with not eating healthy would be the cost. People say healthy foods are more expensive compared to unhealthy foods, or quote unquote junk food. And then some people say, basically, no, I can't cook, and I'm going to go to the drive-thru and pick up something.
Yeah, I think that our lifestyles have changed. I was recently participating in a discussion, and we were talking about globalization, and globalization has to do with the world opening up, as it were. And in past Barbadian society, what we had was the sit down at home, the mother or father or aunt or grandmother, whoever was responsible for cooking, cooked for everybody, and persons partook of meals that were prepared in the home. Now, we have to take our children to swimming after school. We also have to have a board meeting that runs from 6 to 7. The children have lessons, and then you also have a meeting at your church or social club or whatever else. You live at one part of the island, your boss is asking you for something, and therefore that comes, I don't have enough time. And we go to the drive-through and we pick up something that is convenient. As a physician, I'm going to tell you the truth, and I'm saying this publicly. It alarms me when I see the lengths of the lines at our nation's fast food places, some of them snaking around, some of them blocking traffic from progressing. And the thought for me is, as I look at those lines going around the buildings and so on, I look inside. And inside is empty. So things have gotten so bad that we're not even going inside the fast food restaurants for food. We're sitting in our cars to purchase fast food. Let me make it clear before I hear somewhere on the grapevine that Dr. Boyce was bashing fast food. There is nothing wrong with fast food. The problem comes when fast food is your staple. When 4 out of the 7 days of the week, 5 out of the 7 days of the week, you are consuming food that is high in calories, high in fat, and nutrient poor. And I firmly understand my fellow nation persons. I understand what it is to be busy. I am in the process of divesting several things from my portfolio because I understand what it is to be busy. But as most of you do, I also understand what is necessary in order to be healthy. And therefore, we have some choices to make. Let's get to this one, Brian, about it being too costly to eat properly.
I think the major challenge with healthy eating or eating healthy, it really comes down to planning. Planning what meals you're going to prepare. I think that's very important. I know persons, especially if you're a person who prepares their meals in a haphazard manner. So it's therefore you can't go to the market and you can't buy the vegetables when they're reasonable. You're not going to buy the things when they're in season. You may just grab and go. And that is where the cost is attached. When a person's going to the supermarket and they actually purchase vegetables which are pre-cut or pre-shredded, again, there's a cost attached to that as well. If you purchase meat, fish, or poultry, which is already pre-cut, again, there's going to be an increased cost attached to that as well too. So the key thing here is that you need to plan, and you need to, again, buy things that are in season. And if you adopt some of those habits, I think the cost can be reduced significantly.
Yeah, let's say good evening to Dr. Adrian Lord. I hold Dr. Lord very near and dear to my heart. And he was mentioning some of the things that he hears in his office. And one of them, and it happens, most of the doctors will also tell you that one of the remarks that comes when people stand on the scale is that, "Doc, your scale is wrong." Our scales are always wrong. "Oh, no, I can't weigh that much. The last time I weighed, I didn't weigh so much." When was the last time you weighed? So good evening to you, Dr. Lord, and thank you for always being willing to jump on and participate and to be a guest here on the show as well. I do remember years ago, Professor Henry Fraser, he had an answer, and you alluded to it here, Brian. He had an answer to the fact that persons were complaining about the cost of food. And he said the same thing. You purchase things when they are in season. Therefore, if there is a glut of cucumbers, you drink cucumber juice, you eat pickle, you put cucumbers on at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. If you need a snack, you slice up some cucumber and so on. And there's always I remember, Gretchen, remember that there was a show before where somebody was talking about, and I have their number. They were talking about they buy things in bulk and how they cut them up and store them in the freezer. We had yes, some persons on.
That is true.
Yeah, they had called in, and so I can't remember his name. I'll find the number and give him a call. But yes, so persons do realize the benefit of purchasing food when it is cheaper. And I'm going to lay myself bare here. I don't cut up chicken. I do not cut up chicken. I do not bone fish. It was so bad that that was one of the four things I said to my husband, I'm not going to do for you. So let me know now if you're going to accept me with these two deficiencies, cutting up chicken and boning fish. So, so
apparently you won. Apparently you won. You're here.
Yes, that is true. So you have to decide, you know, what you're going to do. So either the other people in your house cut up the chicken and bone the fish, or you spend a little extra in supermarkets and get the pre-cut. But in all seriousness, we understand that there are things that we can do to reduce the amount of money that we spend in the supermarket. Another thing that we can do, that was another suggestion, is bulk shopping. So you shop with your family, bulk shop, and divide up whatever it is that you buy. So let me ask you a question. What is your current occupation, profession, title? This is going somewhere.
Yeah, I'm currently the assistant or deputy nutrition officer.
And what does the deputy nutrition officer do? Because there are many persons in the island that are not even aware that there is a national nutrition office. So we want to allow persons to know that there is such a thing. So what do you do on a daily basis? Hopefully it's work.
Yeah, most definitely. I currently still have some capacity at Mason Scott Polyclinic, where I operate in the capacity of a community nutrition officer. But I also work with the long-term care facilities, the government-run long-term care facilities, the elderly care facilities. So I work primarily with food service. And I also work in nutrition policy as well, too. So I wear several hats.
Okay, so in terms of nutrition policy, what does your role entail? Because we're trying to get people to understand that really it's not just people sitting down behind a desk, but there are things that are being done to try to get us to become a more healthy nation. So what are some of the policies? And we'll get into some of the activities that are coming up in the month of May. But what are some of the things in which you are involved? You talked about the lung care facilities. Do you determine what patients eat, the quality of food, from where it's sourced?
In terms of the long-term care facilities, what I would do is that I would provide technical assistance to the food service departments in terms of menu planning and menu design. And, you know, we would also see patients who maybe having challenges within the long-term care facility as well. Wearing the policy hat, I think most recently what the National Nutrition Center did, we actually coordinated the development of the Barbados School Nutrition Policy, again, which is like a very comprehensive document, which really outlines or guides educators in terms of how best the school or how the school food environment should look.
A couple of years ago, perhaps pre-COVID, if my memory serves me correctly, I had a bit of a stint with the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Barbados. And over there, there is an association with the youth gym. But at that time, the focus was on trying to deal with getting the sugar sweetened beverages out of our schools, trying to get children to drink more water. And a couple of years ago, again, we did something called the Health of the Nation survey. And the statistics coming out of that were not good statistics for Barbados. As healthcare professionals, it spoke volumes about the gravity of the situation here in Barbados. I think one of the problems for me that occurs with diabetes and hypertension is that they don't hurt. some person that has, let's say, appendicitis, acute inflammation of the appendix, appendicitis, they will get to the doctor quick, fast, and in a hurry because of the pain, the vomiting, the fever, being unwell. But persons who are diabetic and hypertensive, in those stages where there are no symptoms, because believe you me, symptoms turn up eventually, but in those years where there are no symptoms, persons don't make any adjustments in their lifestyles. And certainly, and I can see your facial expression, you agree, there are persons who have been told of the need to make those adjustments and they don't. Again, I'm asking you for your clinical experience. What do you think are some of the reasons that persons don't make those changes?
I think what I'll say first is that I think behavior change is something which is very difficult to achieve. I think for me, the challenges is that if a person has been living a particular way for the last 15, 20, 25 years, and they come and see a person like myself or come and see a doctor like yourself, and we tell them, you need to stop eating certain kinds of foods or cut down the sugar sweetened beverages or avoid the fast food. Again, it's very tough for that person. However, so in terms of what I would do as a nutrition professional, again, it's more so about educating the person. And as you so eloquently pointed out, a person can be diabetic, hypertensive, have cardiovascular issues 5, 10, 15 years and not have any overt symptoms. But again, as things begin to cascade and as their health begins to deteriorate, then the secondary complications tend to develop. And at that point, which is really sad, and at that point is when a person may actually then spring into action to try to address the issues they have. And the key thing here, I said some persons, because again, then there are other persons who you would never reach, you know? So that is a huge aspect, behavior change.
Yeah, I recall years ago, my dad told me a story of a gentleman who went to see a physician, and this is years ago, and she cautioned him that he needed to reduce the salt in his diet. And one of the things that I'll say that after, but he said, okay, doc, I'm going to do what you say to do. So he goes, supposedly doing what the doctor has said that he should do. And he comes back and his blood pressure is still alarmingly high. And she asked him, you know, so what is it that you've been doing and so on? He said, doc, you could talk from now till next year, but I can die with a piece of salt meat between my teeth. And unfortunately, of course he did. But this is the mentality that persons really do have. And I mentioned salt meat because it came to me as a surprise that persons did not think that cooking with salt meat, get it? Salt meat was extra salt in their diet. And I mean the looks of horror when I said to patients, you understand that this is salt meat and that this is something that you really should not be cooking with. And persons are surprised, just like condensed milk. Persons who were diagnosed with diabetes were not aware that they shouldn't be using condensed milk. So it behooves us as physicians and healthcare professionals to take that time to explain to patients what really they should and should not do. And again, right, it's not a whole set of hard and fast rules about don't eat this, don't eat that, but the education. And I like the word that you use every time we chat. You always say moderation. Let's talk a little bit about moderation.
Yeah, I think moderation is important. As you pointed out before, I think persons, when persons hear about sodium, they don't automatically point to the stock cubes, or they don't automatically assume we're talking about the packaged seasonings. So when people hear about sodium and salt, they only talk about salt. So, and I think for me, the important thing, as I often tell people, is not that it's going to be impossible, especially in today's society, to cut out all of the salt or all the sugar out of your diet. But the key thing here is moderation. And I will go a bit further and say, it's all about reducing the amount of added sugars and added sodium and added fats, which are in the diet. Because again, these things occur in our diet naturally. But the key thing here is the salt or the sugar or the fat that you add to particular foods.
Yeah, I look back over my childhood and I see my parents cooking, and back in the day, you know, education really wasn't there, and it was almost like a pot spoon of salt to a pot. And then you become educated, you hear different things, you see the ads on television and so on, and you recognize, oh, this really is not healthy. And you gradually reduce the amount of salt to the point where you go out and you can pick up salt in somebody else's cooking. And sometimes there are places you can't eat because the food really is too salty. And I remember actually eating a particular food from a particular place, and I couldn't finish what I had because the food was so salty to me till it was almost bitter. And I couldn't eat it. So I'm not sitting down here on a platform or a soapbox telling persons, you know, that my diet is the best. It isn't. Up to today, I had a piece of a brownie, about 3/4 of a brownie. But I'm not going to go and eat a brownie tomorrow. And I'm not going to eat another one, certainly on tomorrow's Monday, Tuesday, on Tuesday. Trying my best to be that example for my patients, for my children. And like you say, Brian, I almost call you B. Sorry. as you said, behavior change is not an easy thing at all. What are some of the steps you think that persons can put into place? And we're going to talk about this under two conditions. Let's talk about it first under behavior change. What are some of the things that persons can do to help with behavior change? And this is from the perspective of the healthcare provider as well as the patient.
I think what you described earlier was actually retraining of your taste buds, so that when you eat out, you tend to pick up the sodium and the sugar very quickly. But in terms of what people can do, I think a very simple thing a person can do to give them an idea in terms of what they're doing or what they're eating anyway is if they were just do like a food diary, for instance. And write down all the beverages and all the foods that they eat over a particular day. And I find when persons do that and they actually have a visual, they're like, wow, I actually eat all this. Like, I think in our society these days, I think we've become grazers. And by grazers, I mean we're constantly eating. And for some people, when we realize how much we're actually eating over the course of the day and drinking, especially because drinking is a very, very deceptive thing, because we tend not to perceive the calories that we drink compared to the calories that we eat. So once people have an idea in terms of what they're actually putting in their system, that can be a bit of a wake-up call. And I tell persons also do an activity diary. And when you look at your diary over the course of the week or over the course of a few days, and you realize it has been a week and I haven't done 1 minute of strenuous physical activity, I think that itself can turn the light on in their mind.
One of the things I realized, we had the privilege of working at the same institution, and for our present company included, I will not again mention the name of that institution because there's always an issue when I call the name of that institution. Nevertheless, whilst I was working there, I thought that I was super active, moving from my office, going over to another department and coming back and, you know, pushing patients in a wheelchair and then going to consult with somebody else, running across to the pharmacy. And I actually got one of those watches at the time that measured your steps. And I was the most shocked person that when I realized that with all the activity I thought that I was involved in, I hardly made steps during the day. So in addition to underestimating what we eat, we underestimate our physical activity. We're going to get back to this, but we have a call now. We'll take that call and get back to chatting with you. Good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Good evening, Dr. Boyce, to you and your guests and to Greg Stinn.
Hi, good evening.
I have a question for the dietitian. We always talk about salt and sugar and fat, but we never hear about fruits and the advantages and disadvantages of fruits. Like, for example, using fruits that has a lot of potassium this year, if you use like a lot of bananas, the amount of potassium in the bananas is not good for you. I would like to know if there's any truth to that, and what you would call moderation in terms of eating bananas. Because let me just say this, right? I love bananas and I love grapes. I'm going to eat bananas, I eat 4 or 5 or something, as much as 6 if they're small in a 24-hour period. And if I eat grapes, I eat as much as a pound of grapes.
Yeah, I'm with you there with the grits, my friend.
Pardon?
If only we could see facial expressions over the radio. Our nutritionist has his hand pressed against his forehead and he's shaking his head. So we understand very well what that means.
So I would like to explain to him what is the advantages or the disadvantages about being a person that likes so much bananas and grapes. I eat a fair amount in a 24 to 36 hour 24 to 40-hour period. I would listen to see and respond after says silence after he's responded to me.
Sure, of course. I think we need to first ask in terms of what a person's underlying health conditions may be. So let's say a person may be diabetic, may have renal issues. So the fact is that consuming these things in excess could affect a person's underlying conditions. I mean, on its own, having a single banana or a small to medium-sized banana would be considered a serving. And the thing about fruits and vegetables is that we encourage persons to eat fruits and vegetables every day. But the key thing here, I must stress on the variety, because you must remember that fruits and vegetables have different macro and micronutrient profiles. So therefore, you're going to get, let's say, you mentioned the potassium and the magnesium and the fiber from the bananas. But when you consume, let's say, like orange, you're going to get the vitamin C. You're going to get different nutrients from different fruits and vegetables. And the only way you can really get a measure of balance is when you actually consume a wide variety of fruits and vegetables. And the key thing here is variety. So just to be clear in terms of the question you asked, when persons overconsume fruits, especially if these fruits are very ripe, we need to be very careful in terms of, let's say a person is diabetic, for instance. Like, of course, that can cause spikes in blood sugars. You know, if a person has renal issues, you can maybe take in too much potassium, especially from bananas and fruit from the banana family.
Finish?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I would like to one of these evenings, Dr. Boyce, I would like you to bring in somebody that can talk about these different things, what they really mean to the body, like vitamins, proteins, potassium, all these, you know, magnesium, all these different things. What exactly they mean to the body, what they are, first of all, and what they mean to the body, and if you can do with or without them based on your underlying factors.
Okay, well, that's something I will take into consideration. Thank you for the suggestion.
Anyway, so back to the dietitian. So you are saying then that it's already eat fruits, but your buzzword is in moderation.
Of course, moderation has to be the key. Again, because when you consume too much of anything, whether it be a very ripe fruit, whether you consume too much the carbohydrates or the staples, where you consume too much meat and poultry, again, in excess, of course, you can have negative effects on your health.
Right. Okay, so I suppose, Gregston, we got to cut back on our grips, boy.
Indeed. Easier said than done, though.
that is so true.
Behavior change.
But we definitely have to come.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks a lot, my friend. We got some others trying to get in, so we're going to say goodbye to you. But thanks for your contribution. And let's move on to this next caller, Doc, if you don't mind. Very good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, the Doc can hear you.
Yeah, this is the Doc.
Hi, good evening.
Yes, good evening. I'm a type 2 diabetic, okay? This is about, my granddaughter's 23 years, and I was still about 20. But if they have the new grapes, I will use 3. 3 grapes is enough for me. I don't go fast, I don't use nuts. Nuts is raise your cholesterol, ain't it? Right? If I'm using a banana, it cannot be soft. It has to be half hot. You know, hardy, right? And I remember if I'm using, like, if I'm using an omelet, I put parsley, onion, garlic, but little sunflower into it, and I would have to use lettuce and two slices of toast and a cup of peppermint tea. And I said, my cholesterol's are going up. So, and like my food, I don't use a lot of salt. If I go anybody and eat food, I tell them it's salt, and they say, because you don't use it. So I said, nobody can't cook for me. You want to send me dog? So what I do, I cook my food, and I take it along with me. Everybody going to take my food along with me. That's how you look at life, because, and I use like carrots, broccoli, beets, all those things I use. If I go and bake, I use sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds. I do that mostly for them, and like I don't use a lot of the baking. You understand me? So
yes.
I think I'm on a good path.
Well, what your call has shown us. I think that you're on a relatively good path. We'll let the nutritionist say, but what I am picking up from your contribution is that it is possible. It is possible to make adjustments to your diet, and it is possible to generally eat a healthy meal. What are your considerations? I want to ask you about the nuts and cholesterol there, Brian.
Yeah.
I'm working on it. I must say that. I'm working on it very hard. Because I don't use no more. I took out that. So everything that I cook, like chicken, I boil. If I do fish, I boil. If I do soup, I everything I boil, I do not fry. Don't eat chips or anything like that.
What the caller has described, I think she has made some really good strides in terms of improving her health.
Right.
You know,
and I lose a lot of parts. I lose celery. The celery, I eat it raw because it's good for cramp.
It's fat intake in terms of preparing the meals in a healthy manner. I think those things are very positive. I think what I'll correct you on here is that you said that nuts can actually increase your cholesterol. Nuts contain cholesterol, again, which is not accurate because cholesterol is only found in animal cells or animal foods, whether it be meat, fish, poultry, eggs, bacon, margarine, butter. You know, so it's only found in animal foods. I think what you do get in nuts is nuts are generally very oily. Again, like many legumes, nuts tend to be very oily. So because nuts are generally oily, people then associate it with increasing one's cholesterol. But again, nuts are fatty, whether it be peanuts, almonds, cashews. So they generally, nuts and seeds are generally very fatty. On the contrary, because nuts are very high in fiber, it can actually help to lower your cholesterol. However, what I would say is that for the typical Barbadian like Gregston, when he gets grapes, when a person buys
a bag of nuts,
they will generally eat the whole thing in one or two servings. Again, which is not accurate because a serving size of nuts would be considered a cup handful. You know, so the volume is more so the problem here as opposed to the nuts themselves.
Cholesterol.
If it's good for you, it
is. If I had to lose cholesterol.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Cholesterol would be high in the omega-3, omega-6 fats, which are good for the heart and cardiovascular system. I think traditionally Barbadians use cholesterol oil. They would give to children, and even consume it as adults. So again, it's a good supplement. But again, the key thing here is that you don't only want to focus on the supplements. You want to make sure you consume some of the oily fish, the sardine, the mackerel, salmon.
I don't fry. These years, I don't fry. But one thing that would I think would show me is I know to run like half mile, and I can't get it done now because I take sick, and I will run like a half mile, and I'm 64 now. When I finished it at 60. I was a very, and everybody said, Lorna, how could you come down like this? And when you put on your clothes, your soft ears, you run, you don't stop from running?
I think the challenge is that, again, as we get older, we're unable to do things that we would do 5, 10, 15, even 20 years ago. I can guarantee you I'm currently roughly about 41. And the things that I would do at 20, I can't do those things now.
Because you get older.
Exactly. So it really comes down to making older. The...
But my mindset, like, I still want to get out, you know, and just want to go.
Yeah. Or you can try walking instead. You know, you're still active and you're still getting that physical activity. And we really want to thank you for your contribution. And you've shown Barbadians that it's possible to live a healthy lifestyle.
Yes, you have a nice evening, okay?
All right, thank you kindly.
All right, my dear.
Wonderful, Doc. Another one, if you so desire.
Sure, go ahead.
Very good evening to you. Hello. Well, I guess you don't want to hear me then.
Hello?
Oh, dear, 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 dear. Sound like Mr. Hope. Mr. Hope, please call back. I didn't hear you at first, and I heard a dial tone, and here we go. Let's see if it's him again. Very good evening to you.
Hi, Gregston. This is Craig.
Oh, Madam Craig. That's not disappointing with my voice, by the way. Trust me. I thought I had Hope back again, but carry on, Madam Craig.
Okay, question about popcorn. Just want to know the nutritional value. I'll put down and let Hopi come too.
All right. So it's the nutritional value you want to know of popcorn, correct?
I think popcorn is a good snack, but again, what it is, that it depends on the kind of popcorn you're talking about. If it's going to be the microwave popcorn, if it's going to be the candy popcorn, again, those would be a no-no. But if you're going to pop your, like how my parents would do it, if you're going to pop your popcorn the old-fashioned way, it generally is a good snack as well. Lots of fiber, lots of vitamins, lots of minerals. And the key thing here is that fiber is very high in fiber. Key thing here. But the key thing you want to avoid, the microwave popcorn and the candy popcorn, which is generally high in sugar and high in sodium and trans fats as well in the microwave popcorn.
Yeah, and then when you do your popcorn, you don't throw butter on top of it and add salt. Because you've just destroyed the benefits that you would have gotten from the popcorn by itself.
All right. Very good evening.
Yes, sir.
Ah, he's back. Your colleague Craig not too long called in and she said, let me get off so Mr. Hope can come in. All right, go ahead.
Now, good evening to you, sir. Good evening to the nutritionist and to Dr. Boyce, long time. How are you?
Hi, good evening. I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm not so well. I'm still alive.
Okay.
However, there are questions that I want to ask to the nutritionist. You are just dealing with the nutritional facts or just beyond that to metabolism and requirement?
Okay, I can answer that for the nutritionist. Seeing as how it is now approximately 17 minutes to the hour of 7 here in Barbados and across the Eastern Caribbean, we are just dealing with nutrition. We're not dealing with nutritional requirements. We're not dealing with metabolism. We're not dealing with biochemistry.
Okay. So what I wanted to say there is that when you tell people you have too much salt or you have too much this or you have too much that, a person that's accustomed to eating a bowl of food and you tell them to eat half bowl, it ain't going to make no sense. Because the whole chemistry there, sorry for using that term, or the whole cultural aspect of eating and nutrition is that the body get accustomed to a bowl of food. And even if a bowl of food is double the nutritional requirement or triple it, the person still feels hungry, and therefore the person must be satisfied, or what is known as satiation, by eating a bowl of food. So the question is, how do you re-educate the person that that is just a physiological circumstance and that it can be changed? And that's the problem I think we have here.
I think you mentioned a number of, I think you mentioned, we thank you for the call and the comment, but I think a number of things that you said really stood out to me. And the first thing is hunger. And what I would say is I often tell people in the clinical setting, our friends, if you wait until you're hungry to eat, you're going to overeat. And I also tell people, especially based on your activity level, if you're in your 60s or 70s, there's no value for you to eat the same way you did in your 20s or 30s, because again, you're no longer as active, therefore your calorie requirement is not that significant. And as I often tell people, especially pregnant women, I tell people, it's not about the quantity of food you consume. It's more so about the quality of your diet. So again, you can have a high quality diet, but you don't necessarily need the volume. And again, the big issue here is that culture. We come from a culture where we want a very large amount of rice, a macaroni pie, a very big piece of chicken, but we're going to pass on the vegetables, you know? And so I think we need to there needs to be a paradigm shift where people say, you know what, vegetables are more nutritious, fruits are more nutritious. So you know, let me get a bit of salad. Let me get some shredded carrots, or let me get some more beans and some more peas in the diet. You know, so culture is very, very important. And a bowl of food sounds like a lot of food.
It is a lot. One more thing. We talk about living a sedentary lifestyle, but don't we need to emphasize a sedentary lifestyle means that you are not physically active, and that if you are living a sedentary lifestyle, you must reduce the quota of food as an intake?
I think this is something that I would find a lot in older patients or older clients. The thing about physical activity is that physical activity is an umbrella term which describes a number of things, whether it be structured exercise, whether it be dancing, whether it be walking, whether it be swimming, whether it be dancing. And the general trend is that as we get older, our physical activity declines. And it doesn't necessarily mean that because you're older, you can't be more physically active. But that is just our culture, quote unquote. We think that as we get old, most of us anyway, we should not walk, we should not run, we should not swim. But again, there are segments of the barbarian population who actually do these things as they get older. But again, culture is very important. Another point that Dr. Boyce said earlier, I think she mentioned that when she was working in a different capacity within the lovely institution that we both work for, she mentioned that she'd be up and down, up and down, up and down. And then when she checked her step count, or her activity levels, she realized that she wasn't doing as much as she thought. And the key thing here is that incidental activity is good, though it's good, but it cannot replace structured physical activity. And that is the important thing. And the key term here is vigorous to moderate intensity. Very important.
How much we need to get someone behind us to put in those structural activities?
I think, especially in a society like Barbados, I think I noticed this is probably a bad phrase. I think personal responsibility is very important. Where you know that if you have a challenge with blood sugars or blood pressures, or you have a challenge with your weight, it's important that you, as an individual, say to yourself, you know what, I need to at least go walking 2 to 3 times a week. And you need to be purposeful. And I think that's the key thing. Purposeful in terms of your activity and purposeful in terms of what you eat. Very important.
Well, thank you, sir. Keep emphasizing it.
All right. Thank you kindly. Go ahead, Doc.
Yes, thank you. I just had a belly laugh here when we were talking about the constituents of the typical Barbadian plate, macaroni pie. What's it now? Rice, macaroni pie. This is Sunday. Potato salad, there's fried fish, there's a piece of chicken, and there's conscience salad on the side, just for, you know, just to be able to say that you had vegetables on your plate. But one of the things that we want to discuss, Brian, is what is it that the National Nutrition Center, what are you guys up to this month? Tell us about the activities that you have planned for this month.
I'll say whenever on this program, the time just seems to fly.
Yes.
Again, we launched the National Nutrition Month today, and we had a wonderful church service at the St. George Parish Church, and the Minister of Health and Wellness, the Right Honourable the Minister of Health, he gave a really nice presentation to really sum up our thoughts. In terms of the other parts of the month, again, we launched what we call the Healthy Eating Guide. And I shared an electronic copy of that with you. Very colorful, but again, the material in it is very useful. And the idea is that we want to have a healthy eating guide in every Barbadian home, whether it be a hard copy or whether it be an electronic copy, a wealth of information. We're going to relaunch the National Nutrition Center's website. And that's a website where you can find, where we hope to have a plethora of information, from the healthy eating guide to the different nutrition series that we would do, healthy eating on a budget, nutrition and diabetes, nutrition and cardiovascular disease, nutrition and cancer. So we hope to have lots of information there. And we have several features in the media, both print and both print media and television and radio. And we have a big seminar coming up with the National Council of Substance Abuse on the 17th of May. And throughout the entire month, we're actually going to have several nutrition tips being launched on the airways, you know, for the general public, as food for thought in many ways.
Well, you mentioned the National Council for Substance Abuse. We actually have them on later on this month. So you can listen out here as well on the Better Health Radio Show for the NCSA. And they were here with us, I believe, last year. And it was a wealth of information that they were able to give us about substance abuse and the signs to look for. So I'm looking forward again to having them on the show. For those of you who have been so unfortunate that you are now joining us, we have spent the last 45 to 50 minutes sitting down having a conversation here with Mr. Brian Payne, the Deputy Nutrition Officer at the National Nutrition Center. So the question is, how do patients get to see the nutritionist?
We are stationed at all the roughly 9 polyclinics now. And it really comes down to a doctor referral, a referral from a nurse, or a person expressed an interest to actually see a nutrition professional within the polyclinic setting. And again, it's very easy. I'm tempted to say walk-ins, but again, you don't necessarily have to be referred to by a medical practitioner. And I think the nutrition officers are generally very, very accessible to the patients.
Yeah, one of the things that, looking back on my training in medicine, and I realized that this is going to be 18 years that I have been a doctor. So things have changed in medicine. But back when I was in medical school, we really were not taught nutrition. So there would have been things that we did with respect to general nutrition and so on. But with respect to, and of course, there is, you're not supposed to know everything, because I firmly believe in referring to specialists. That is your area that you have studied, and you are more knowledgeable in that area than I am, and I will refer you as necessary. But I think that it is something that needs to be considered. I cannot speak for what the medical program is today. I put that in there, but I'm saying that, you know, back in the day, we weren't taught. But that being said, we can all research, and there's a wealth of information out there in lies the problem. All of the information that we're given on the internet about what's the one that I asked you about recently? Oh dear me, it's apple cider vinegar, and your facial expressions. There needs to be a way that persons can see these facial expressions. Let's talk about apple cider vinegar. We got a few minutes.
Again, apple cider vinegar is just one thing in a whole smorgasbord of things that people would use. I think some people assume that taking apple cider vinegar is going to cut belly fat. I'm not sure how that's going to, I mean, to me, it doesn't make sense. But people drink it under the pretext of cutting belly fat. But when you think of it logically, I mean, it makes no sense. It makes no sense, at least not to me.
You have just officially upset the apple cart of several people who are convinced that it is the apple cider vinegar that is going to, you know, get them that six pack. But a little bit on fad diets, like you say, the time just disappears.
I think especially around what we would call summer in Barbados, even though we have summer 24/7. But I think people are more inclined to seek out these so-called quick fixes. And again, these quick fixes never work. You know, people may go on these fad diets or these extreme diets where they restrict their calorie intake, or where they restrict their intake of particular food groups in the effort to lose body fat. In many instances, these diets are unhealthy, very unhealthy, and at least these diets are very intolerable. Because when you think of, let's say I'm a person who's going on a diet, like for instance, I'm being like a vegetable, a cabbage soup diet, for instance. Because your calorie intake is going to be so low, this diet is not sustainable. You're going to lose weight, yes. You're going to lose fat, yes. You're going to lose muscle mass also. You know, so, but people tend to gravitate to these quick fixes, and they may do more harm than good, in my opinion.
One of the things that I have said to patients over the years, let's say that there's a patient who weighs 250 pounds, and this is not a person who's lifting weights and who is 6 feet tall and decked with muscle. And what persons don't realize is that much of the symptomatology, much of what you're experiencing, is as a result of the excess weight that you're carrying. So the pain in your knees, the pain in your back, the excess fatigue, you know, the depression that occurs has a lot to do with the weight that you're carrying. And you spoke about the quick fixes. You did not put on 250 pounds in a week. How is it that you expect in a week to lose, you know, 100 of those 250 pounds? Impossible. And the other thing is, it's not possible. And when you start on these restrictive diets and so on, and you don't progress as quickly as you thought you would, then persons become disappointed and we go right back into the unhealthy eating patterns, and it's a vicious cycle. And what you end up doing is weighing more than you did before. Slow and steady wins the race. So I'm not going to be here on the radio telling persons, unlike Brian, Brian is muscular and he eats as a nutritionist should eat most days of the week. He does. Not that I live in his house and I see his food.
I try.
Yeah, so he does try. I've seen some of the food that he eats and so on. So, you know, I could vouch for that a little bit. But I am not going to sit down here and say that I eat perfectly. But certainly the effort is being made. And I remember one of my lecturers had said that you try your best 90% of the time to eat the way you should. And those few times, you know, that you indulge or you fall back, just pick yourself up and go again. Go again. Don't beat yourself up or you'll stay where you are. And the other thing that people do, you know, if you keep doing the same thing over again, you're not going to get different results. You're going to get the same results. So as we wind down, Mr. Payne, what is that one thing that you want to leave with our listeners?
I think the key thing here is that as individuals, we need to set realistic expectations of how we want our lives to look. I think the challenges is that when we think of our health, we think of our health as in today, May the 1st, 2020, 2022. I don't think people really project their health 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. Yeah. And if a person would project their health that time frame, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, they can say, you know what, I'm unhealthy today, or marginally healthy today. In 5, 10, 15 years, I want to be at a particular weight, no diabetes, no cardiovascular issues, no cancer, for instance. And by small changes, reducing sodium, reducing added sugars, reducing added fat, being more physically active, reducing your stress levels, getting more sleep, by doing things like that, you can have excellent, excellent long-term health.
I completely agree. And if you wanted to have the, recipe, pun intended, for a healthy life, you've just heard it there from Mr. Brian Payne, the Deputy Nutrition Officer at the National Nutrition Office. More physical activity, a reduction in those things which are not so good for us, a reduction in stress, and more sleep. I remember, Preston, I'm going to say it again, Professor Roach, we had him on and he almost killed us with the need for 8-10 hours of sleep as adults. And we're there walking around saying, oh my gosh, you know, I get 4 hours of sleep. I'm there, you know, working the grind and you know, doing all of those things, and we're killing ourselves with lack of sleep.
And I'm still guilty.
You remember?
I am still guilty of all that, sadly. sadly.
Behavior change. But I want to say a very big thank you, Brian. A very big thank you. And I take this opportunity to wish you and all the staff at the National Nutrition Office, as well as all of the nutrition officers, those at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, as well as those at our nation's polyclinics and other care facilities, wishing you the best this month and on as we try to make Barbados and Barbadians as healthy as we possibly can. It is good to be back, and I look forward to sharing with you. Next week, we're going to be discussing dementia. So you can think about your questions for that show. Is there somebody in your life who's suffering with dementia? Are you having challenges managing such a person? Well, listen next week to the Better Health Radio Show, and we'll help you to manage dementia. I'm Renee Boyce, Dr. Renee Boyce, and it has been my pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Boyce. And of course, our guest this evening was Brian Payne. Thank you kindly, sir. He's been here before. I'm quite sure he'll be back again. So thanks to both Dr. Boyce and Brian Payne for this evening's presentation of the Better Health Radio Show. And of course, as Doc says, God's willing, next week, Sunday, we'll be back with another edition. So until then, you take care.